Well, welcome back, everybody, to the podcast for Cultural Reformation, brought to you by the Ezra Institute. I'm Dr. Joe Boot, president and founder of Ezra, and it is wonderful to be back again for another episode of the podcast, live from our, well, I guess you're watching the recording, so it's not live now, but we are here live at ReformCon, out of the ashes, here in Arizona. And we're taking the opportunity that we get, you know, maybe annually at a major event like this, to speak to some of our good friends, our fellows, and our lecturers about some of the issues that they are addressing as we think about what it means for us as believers to rebuild culture biblically in terms of the kingdom of God and the lordship of Jesus Christ. This is much more than about some political idea. We're not talking about politics as such. We're talking about a biblical world and life view and how that applies to every area of life, including the political. And so those of you who are regular listeners will know that that is what the Ezra Institute is all about. Well, this opportunity we have today on the podcast is to speak to a really good friend of the Institute who actually does kind of behind the scenes work for us, which I won't go into on the show, whose name you will no doubt recognize. And who has spoken at events with us before. I get the opportunity to see our guest. Usually I run into him two or three times a year somewhere in America, and that is David Barnson. Those of you who are theonomic and have done the reading will know of the ministry of Greg Barnson and the impact that David's father had on my own thinking and that of the Ezra Institute. But David himself is managing partner of the Barnson Group. As he sometimes says, as a young man, found himself in a certain sense an orphan, penniless, but learned to trust and obey the living God. And God has used him mightily, and it's a privilege for us to have him on the podcast today. David, thank you very much for joining me and being at ReformCon this year. We so appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to be with us.
Well, it's my privilege. It's a blessing to be here and excited to be with you now.
So, David, I know that you're in a realm and work and serve in a realm that's a mystery to many people, the realm of finance. One of the things that you've been addressing today at the conference was this whole idea of rebuilding culture through the marketplace, which is much more than about money and the management of money. And I thought it would be great for us to have an opportunity to chat with you just about some of the key thoughts that you were articulating to a very mixed audience today, not all white-collar office management type people who've got their own little portfolios that they're managing, but people who are looking after farms, running small family businesses, some people who are. I was speaking to people today, some from the airline industry, others in banking. There's a wide spectrum of people. And so you've been talking about what does it mean to think about the growth and expansion of the kingdom of God through the marketplace. And you identified five areas. I want to sort of, in a certain sense, give our listeners a sort of potted sense of what you said. I wrote them down. The first one was work is more than transactional. What do you mean by that? Work is more than transactional. Help us understand that.
And I think the key there is more than transactional, which is different than saying work is not transactional, because work does achieve, work is instrumental in that by work we provide for ourselves, by work we provide for our families, by work we achieve the means to give to organizations like Ezra, to give to our local churches, whatever those causes may be. Work has transactional benefits, but I think the great theological error is when we reduce work to merely transactional and miss the greater kingdom purpose of work, which is by work we live out what it means to be made in the image of God, that creative and productive, useful purpose for humanity that God made us for. That is fundamentally what work is. that's a much larger calling. There's a certain degree of excitement one, the human spirit can generate over, oh, by work, I will put food on the table. It's motivational, but it's a very different motivation than by work, I achieve my created purpose. So I want us to find a greater, more holistic kingdom mindset about work that transcends the transactional.
One of the myths that you mentioned that, you know, I come across all the time, and I'll be actually this month later, sorry, in May, speaking to business leaders in Toronto on a biblical view of work. And I address the myth that I noticed you picked up on in your talk, is that actually even as Christians, we often think about work as a product of the fall. As though work is a curse. Can you comment on that? And is there a difference between the average person just thinking about having a job in that transactional sense and the biblical idea of vocation?
Well, this is one of the more confusing exegetical errors people make because it's so easily refutable by the very verse before it. The idea that work is the curse stems from a reading of Genesis 3:16 and 17. There's no question that after Adam and Eve sinned, and for those of us who believe there was a real historical moment that we call the fall that altered history, I understand that the work we were created for before the fall took on the curse that is essentially described as the sweat of the brow and thorns and thistles. But in the very immediate verse, they refer to the curse of pains of childbirth. And nobody that I've ever read in Christendom has interpreted that verse to mean children are a curse.
No.
So we recognize that children are a blessing, but the pains of childbirth are a curse. And we ought to recognize that work is a blessing, but the sweat of the brow is the curse. And these are perfectly logical and theological ideas that parallel one another between the two respective curses. So that's what I mean. It isn't a very hermeneutically challenging thing to get to, unless one wants to say that they believe children are a curse, but then they're going to run into a lot of other verses.
Well, sometimes we hear people talking about, and this is very common to hear the unbeliever talking this way too, but I notice Christians talk about it in this way, a work-life balance rather than a work-rest balance, as though work is something that, well, you know, I guess we've got to do it to survive. But it's not really life. Life is recreation, leisure, as opposed to rest, to thinking about the biblical conception of rest.
Well, that's it's a whole chapter in my book. And so one of the reasons I'm speaking on this topic here at ReformerCon is I wrote a book called Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life. And that language about work-life balance versus a work-rest paradigm, I suggest in the book is not just semantics. It's not a mere debate over vocabulary. I think it's a very important substantive difference because it's incoherent if work is a vital part of our life. It's incoherent to suggest that something vitally part of our life has to be balanced with our life. And the point I've tried to make in the book and in speeches I've given since the book came out is the only thing we talk about that way. Nobody believes that marriage and life balance is an issue we're trying to wrestle with. And if we do, we certainly don't say it to our spouses, right? And so I would suggest that it's manipulative language used to promote a low view of work.
Discovering that point at which we recognize that as human beings, God has called us to be productive. There's that, in a certain sense, there's a conserving element to the tend and keep, but then there's that, and you talked about it in your lecture, you know, I think you held up a mobile phone and said, you know, this is the most successful market product in the history of man. You know, everything that God had placed within creation, all that potentiality had to be brought forth by human ingenuity, ideation, and work being something that is an incredible gift. But that sweat of the brow that comes with it. That, of course, is the thing that, that creation offers a certain peculiar kind of resistance to us since the fall that makes it arduous. No. We call it laboriousness. No. It's labor intensive, and that leads to a tendency in human beings to procrastinate, to cut corners, to do the minimal. You talked quite a bit about that. Maybe that's a little bit related to the second point that you made. You talked about repudiating self-pity and victimhood, and I think sometimes that halts that the reality of the curse, that there is a laboriousness at times to work. And it doesn't matter what kind of work you're in. I think, you know, the grass is always greener. Some people who are working on the farm think, oh, if only I could be in the in an office and have a cushy desk job. And the folk in the office think, oh, it'd just be so wonderful. I could just go and work with my hands. And, you know, but the reality is whatever you're doing, the creation in a sinful world offers resistance to that productivity. And righteousness and obedience has to help us, with the, in the power of the Spirit, push through that tendency to self-pity. So tell us a bit more about what you were saying about victimhood and self-pity in this context.
And I think you're exactly right, that there is a part of sinful nature that migrates to self-pity, and it's not hard to do. Within the curse, one can say, you know, Proverbs makes fun of it. We say, I can't go to work today. There's a lion that will eat me in the streets. You know, there's this sort of, the things humans are willing to say as an excuse for procrastination, for idleness, for apathy. And today it's pretty easy for believers, and this would be true in UK and Canada and the United States. This is reasonably true throughout the developed world. Christians can run into resistance for being Christians. Mm-hmm. And they could use that as an excuse to say, I can't get ahead in the marketplace. They hate me because I won't use the right pronouns, or they'll hate me because I've taken a stance on culture war issues, or just because I'm a believer. That itself, I don't doubt at all that discrimination exists. I do doubt significantly that we're running into the drama of resistance that we often hear we are. I think most people still have the ability to perform and produce through it. Mm-hmm. But even where that persecution does exist, and it shouldn't, we should fight against it and use all legal means necessary to fight back. But no, the mentality needs to be one, not of victimhood, not of I can't flourish in the marketplace because woe is me, but rather believing that we are emboldened by the Spirit to greater, bigger things. And so I use the line today that I don't really believe we're in a neutral world or a negative world. I just believe we're in God's world.
Yeah.
And that ought to be very empowering to those of us trying to perform certain things in the society.
Mm-hmm. The when you look at the West, and I don't want to digress too far, but I think it's related. In the 19th century, you know, my home country, Britain, incredibly wealthy, incredibly prosperous, building in a certain sense, seeing a form of reconstruction around the world of the export, if you will, of certain values that was releasing the beginnings of an economic miracle. Mm-hmm. And part of that was free markets. And of course, you can't have without private property, you can't have free markets. So the idea, that specifically Christian, distinctly biblical idea of free markets that prospered in Britain, and this right to private property, property rights being so critical. So Britain, you know, had that great century, the 19th century. America today, when we think about the question of self-pity and victimhood, well, America in the 20th century became the most successful economy in the world. Americans, the most prosperous people in the world. You know, we kind of traded places. Mm-hmm. And I know it's a complex story of how that happened. But is there something there in terms of the Christian roots of America, of a lack of victimhood mentality, that eschewing of self-pity, and that what's sometimes been called that Protestant work ethic of saying, you know, well, under the sovereignty of God, we're going to be productive, we're going to work, we're going to serve, and you know, many countries from around the world will want to come to America still to this day because of the tremendous prosperity of the largest economy by far in the world. Can you comment on that? In relation to this question of self-pity and victimhood, one of the things I love about Americans and being in America is that it reminds me of what my own nation used to be like.
Yeah.
There's a can-do, generally speaking, there is a can-do mentality. There's a spirit of generosity.
Yeah.
And of this can be done, and a willingness to put one's hand to the plow and not just say, well, the state's going to do it all for me, and this expectation that I'm going to get cradle to grave security like the dying welfare economies of Europe. Is there a relationship between what you've talked about, victimhood and self-pity, and the American economy? The miracle of the American economy.
And this whole issue you're getting to not only speaks to a backward-looking diagnosis of what may have happened with former superpowers like UK, but it's a warning shot to America as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because what is also rooted in this, when you talk about private property being codified in the law of God, the Eighth Commandment, we believe in private property because thou shalt not steal doesn't make sense apart from it.
Yeah.
There's another commandment that is vital to our economic understanding that is itself a huge critique of the Marxian philosophy that became so popular in the mid-19th century. This was largely the reason that American 20th century productivity took off, was that the 19th century America was willing to go against class warfare, class struggle. This came about as a violation of the 10th commandment.
That's right.
So thou shalt not covet, which is sort of the grand finale of the Decalogue, is incredibly important to economics. America will lose its superpower status if we want to go full throttle on demonizing success, on repudiating meritocracy. If our self-pity and victimhood gets so bad that we actually look down upon entrepreneurialism and risk-taking, then this is what stagnates an economy. And it is very much something that happened in a lot of the Western European nations. Mm-hmm. So covetousness is a spiritual problem that becomes an economic malady.
Mm-hmm.
Not believing in private property is a spiritual problem that becomes an economic malady. The richest countries on earth are ones that celebrate private property, create a structure around it with rule of law, and allows for this exchange of goods and services that helps humans flourish, but also repudiates covetousness.
Mm-hmm.
And fundamentally, I think you could tell what the economic upside of a country is, not merely by what the most productive people do, but why folks that are slightly less productive think about the most productive people.
Yeah.
Most Americans have historically looked up to the most productive people. And the day we start demonizing them, that's the end of the republic, in my opinion. And that's a key issue going forward.
Yeah, I think one way of articulating that is that the U.S. Hasn't typically taken the posture of cutting off the heads of its tallest poppies.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, in the what's happened in much of Europe, and very sadly in a lot of the UK today, is we like to cut down and chop off those that grow taller. And you know, we're in a season right now where we've got millionaires, we've got a socialist government in, we've got millionaires fleeing the country. So that covetousness is a real issue.
But that wealth inequality debate, there's a very famous clip that your own Lady Thatcher that you would rather that the poor get poorer just as long as the rich don't get richer. I think that this is why spiritually Christians need to repudiate a focus on wealth inequality and a focus on income inequality, because intrinsically it forces us to be covetous.
Mm-hmm.
Where any Christian view of economics, of marketplace, of activity, entrepreneurially, that is not focused on lifting all stations, you know, that's ultimately what we want, is everybody to be able to prosper and grow. Mm-hmm. And there will be different, you know, some I expect that the Elon Musks of the world will always get richer at a quicker pace than certain people, because there's just tremendous scale in the talent and the genius and the productivity that is there with some of these folks. But there is no scenario that has ever been created that we can make the Elon Musks of the world poorer without making the poor poorer.
Yes.
We've never come up with it. We're not going to.
No.
And we have to spiritually reject the even objective of it.
Yeah.
And instead focus on productivity, work, these topics we're talking about today.
Yeah. Well, that whole area of larceny, covetousness, I think is related to actually your third point, which was the grift. Mm. You know, urging people not to engage in grifting. And you might want to give us a definition of that. But there's a temptation, I think, in where actual true productivity, true market value starts to decline, for pretenders to come in and think, well, there's a shortcut. There's a quick and easy way to wealth, right? And this is the thing, isn't it? Covetousness feeds that, also that desire to get rich quick schemes. And certainly modern technologies have allowed new avenues to open up for the grift. Rather than focusing my life in on discipline, self-discipline to really become excellent at something and produce value, to try and basically pull the wool over people's eyes, to con them to an inauthenticity. And we're seeing that everywhere. You talked a fair bit about that. Help us understand that, the grift, and how, you know, we've got to resist that as believers.
Well, I try to spend a lot of time in my economic work on focusing on the most senior levels of grift, which are in cronyism, which is the ability of very entrenched and successful companies to wed themselves to state power, mm-hmm. for the purpose of putting a fence around their business and holding out competitors, using the regulatory apparatus to benefit their own company and hurt others. And most people have no problem rejecting that cronyism strikes them as really
unfair and unjust,
mm-hmm. and therefore unbiblical. I would suggest that that's a sort of senior level of grift. It requires resources to be truly cronyistic. You have lobbyists and lawyers and accountants that are all kind of in on the crime, if you will. But at a much more pedestrian level, I think that it is the attempt to try to monetize something absent value, that you're not producing goods and services that serve people that in any sustainable way, but it's essentially a con. And the problem with this is that there is a kind of explicit category that's easy to identify. When someone goes out and says, I'm selling magic beans and they're gonna cure you of your disease and they do no such thing and they got paid. The snake oil stuff. We all would critique a lot of that. But are we willing to critique those that are marketing certain Christian brands and labels, that really the value proposition of the product is nothing more than buy this from me, I'm a Christian.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it's sustainable. I don't think everyone doing it is self-aware. That's why I asked in my talk today to have the self-awareness to really contemplate, do that introspection. Is there some grift going on here? How can you do something that goes, you know, I don't know if this was ever a thing in UK, but in the US, out of the Jesus movement of the 70s, there became this thing of the Jesus fish getting branded around a lot of people's businesses or whatnot. And I think that's the kind of mentality I'm talking about, that you're not looking to compete in the marketplace with a better good or service. You're looking to sort of label just the mere existence of your faith as somehow part of your marketing proposition. Mm-hmm. There's some grift to that.
Yeah.
And it's not as easily identifiable as state power cronyism, but maybe it's equally corrosive.
Yeah. That whole challenge of, I think it's related to what we were saying earlier, that part of the goal of this marvel, this God-created marvel of the marketplace, is that we, in some respects, we're alleviating the effects of the curse. There's a sense in which what we're offering, what we're bringing to people, is bringing rest. You know, the person who invented the, and I wish it had been, maybe we couldn't afford one, but when dishwashers were being invented, you know, these were coming out in the 70s and 80s, yeah. You know, there was a certain amount of rest that was being introduced there, right? There was just some alleviation of the curse, because actually, properly used, instead of, you know, usually two or three members of the family having to go and spend all the time doing the dishes after dinner, there could be a quicker process. And then there's an opportunity for more family time. Now, some might say, well, we had fellowship around the sink. Well, that's true too. But if you look at
isn't that all technology? Even going back to the fire?
True.
Or a wheel?
Yeah.
It was all to enhance productivity for greater efficiency.
Yes.
And the creation mandate theologically is that when you make a process more efficient, you do so towards the purpose of greater productivity.
Yeah.
The secular view is you do so towards the process of stagnating productivity, but you just simply now can have more rest time, play time, party time, leisure, you know.
Interesting. Yeah.
I think that's the issue, is why did the internet, something as absolutely transformative as the internet, which is still, if you think about it, just a mystery.
Yeah.
That we can just go on a screen and all of a sudden buy things and talk to each other and see information. It's and yet productivity hasn't gone up in 30 years. Mm-hmm. We didn't parlay the internet to greater productivity. We parlayed it into sort of stagnating activity.
Yeah. Yeah, there's sort of a difference between a kingdom and a utopian imperative there, right? The utopian imperative is a workless world. That was the Marxist dream, of course, rather than a productive world.
Yeah.
But there's a sense in which what we're trying to bring to the market is something that's going to advance the kingdom of God and be productive of, bring something of true and genuine value. And that can't be done without a certain amount of hard work, self-discipline, excellence, you know, focusing on something and sticking at it.
And also failure.
Willingness to fail.
Willingness to fail, risk-taking. This is why I myself work in finance. You talked about at the very beginning that it could be very mysterious of a domain for people. And a whole entire talk on a theology of finance is a very separate subject from our talk, but today on work. But finance is a tool that is just simply something attached to work. It's capital markets are a means to an end of value creating activities, and there are various ways in which finance has to play into that. But both of them are targeted towards the same end: work that is serving needs of others.
Yeah.
Finance is itself serving that work, the development of that product. Are we comfortable with the idea that we have to learn from trial and error? Proverbs talks about this over and over again. The idea that there's something unbiblical about a product that isn't successful is totally untrue. Jesus talked about the parable of the talents. We want to go out and take big swings for the fences, but we can't do that as a Christian church if the only people that can invest are people that can't afford to lose their capital.
Mm-hmm.
There has to be loss-absorbing capital in our economy.
Yeah.
And that's a very Christian concept, proverbially. So that's why our kind of holistic understanding of this in terms of economics, in addition to the theology of work, is very important.
Yeah. And so if we're going to, as Christians, think about this whole issue to avoid the grift, identify human need, and then offer something of value.
That's right.
And we can avoid that. Very quickly then, because I want to be respectful of your time, there is your fourth point was, what was it here? Repudiating,
Trying to be very, holistic, repudiating a selectivity.
Selectivity. That's right. I'd only written half the word here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Repudiating selectivity. Help us understand that. What do you mean by that?
I think that nobody is really immune from it, but I'm trying to encourage us to be very holistic as Christians, when we say, okay, we really want to see a full engagement in the marketplace, that it would be very elitist and problematic if I said, all that means is fellow finance guys. I just simply want more Christians on Wall Street. That's where the real stuff happens. What you guys are doing in the classroom doesn't matter. All you factory workers, I don't care about. Trying to create this sort of caste system.
Yeah.
That would be a very elitist. But of course, it's also problematic if Christians say, all we care about is the classroom, or all we care about is the church service. So all we, you know, that there's essentially a multifaceted diversity in God's creation, agriculturally, technologically, financially. There's all these different spheres of society. And my view is that a Christian's calling into technology versus agriculture versus these different domains is a byproduct of the individuality that God made us all with, our unique giftedness, our unique skills, and our passions and interest. But I think a lot of Christians have decided, you know, all the most purity we will find in it is for blue collar workers, and they're against, you know, suit and tie guys saying, oh yeah, the blue collar folks don't matter much. I'm trying to advocate for something that is decidedly non-elitist, not a respecter of persons, but rather respects the diversity of creation in the marketplace. And a lot of times in American culture, it goes back all the way to the very early founding of the Republic, that the agrarian folks didn't trust the urban folks and the urban folks didn't trust the agrarian. But, you know, there is a certain diversity in modern life that is amoral. There's no intrinsic superiority of one in suburbia versus rural life versus urban life. The same is true in the marketplace. But I think too many Christians have decided to pigeonhole where they believe there is marketplace opportunity only into one domain, where I think what we need is all of the above focus.
A couple of things strike me there. One is there's been a tendency, if we're honest, and I think you did touch on this in the Q&A, among Christians even, especially among Christians, when it comes to that diversity question, there's a kind of biblical egalitarianism that you're talking about there, really, about recognizing the value of all of these different areas. But there's been a tendency to think that actually only the church-related stuff,
right?
Only the stuff that's seen as, you know, advancing evangelism in some way, or diaconal care, or something that's ecclesiastically associated. There is a kind of hierarchy, a kind of elitism there. If, you know, I guess you touch on this in your book, you know, are you in full-time ministry, brother? You know, that means, are you really in the church bringing true value, and the other guys are there just to write checks?
But this is supposed to have been one of the cornerstones of the Reformation.
True.
The priesthood of all believers is supposed to be a unique proposition of reformational thought. There is no one who has less of an excuse than a son or daughter of the Reformation for saying something like that. And it is based, I referred to it in Q&A as the dualist error, a sacred secular distinction. But in the book, I take it a little bit further. I think it is largely part of the Gnostic heresy. There is an elitism that is coming from this false notion in the elite element of a certain spirituality versus the kind of dirty elements of the material universe. It's just not a mentality that God had.
No. I some years back, I remember seeing a very, very short documentary. It can't have been more than 7 minutes long. And it was about the pencil, right? The manufacture of the miracle of that, how this, you know, all the different people involved in delivering the simplest thing called a pencil to the market, the felling of the trees, the mining of the lead, the logistics of the transportation, the manufacturing process of how you get that lead to be wrapped in a piece of wood, the aesthetic finishing of that pencil, then the getting of that pencil to the market, and
all those components of supply chain. You couldn't make one for less than $15 million. You can buy one for 2 cents.
Exactly. Now there's a miracle to that, in terms of the absolute miracle of that cooperation. Of when you actually bring people together around a common purpose, of how that value proposition, as you say, to make that yourself, the cost of selling that single pencil.
But we take it for granted because markets do that. They enable us to take things for granted. But where Christians have a special blessedness here is we can identify where the miracle comes from.
Yeah.
God had made the human person with the capacity for mutual cooperation, division of labor, specialization of skills, scarcity and creation around resources that can be harnessed in mind, All a pencil is, and this video is made by a group called
Feed. Oh, you know it.
No, okay. Very well. I play it for my economics students.
Really?
At the Christian high school that I started. It's a fundamental.
I play it at my Worldview Academy for the young people.
I love it. I mean, so great minds think alike, I guess. But it is basically an embodiment of so many components of the human person as created by God.
Yeah.
And manifested in markets, and why it's incumbent upon us to defend a market economy to promote the conditions for human flourishing.
Yeah.
Because otherwise a pencil is going to cost $15 million.
Yeah. Well, let's finish here. Your last point was a beautiful one, and it's actually summed up in a very old hymn.
Yeah.
Trust and obey. There's no other way to be happy in Jesus. And you said that core piece of counsel that you've sought to live by, in the end, in this whole area of cultural transformation and the marketplace, you've got to trust God. You have to obey God. Give us your closing thoughts on what it means to trust and obey. What are you trying to convey there to us?
I think that on the obedient side, let's maintain a rigorous commitment to Christian ethics. That many people in business and in other elements of commercial life will find opportunities to cut corners, will find opportunities to cheat, will feel tempted by ability to get ahead with something they shouldn't do. And let's remember obedience. Let's remember why we don't want to fall prey to that temptation. And then I believe on a more positive side, let's remember that in trusting God, we are trusting in our Creator who provides for us, who loves us. It's interesting, when we talk about our own salvation and we talk about God saving us from sin, most people really appreciate the grace of God in saving them. But when they talk about their own careers and work opportunity, they forget that it's the same God who saved them, who called them to this. And that's what I mean by trusting God. That you're not one who needs to be afraid of a lion eating you in the street, so you're going to stay in bed. You can get up out of bed, go engage the world, and you can find joy. You can find purpose.
Yeah.
You will, because of sweat of the brow, you will run into struggle.
Mm.
But through the struggle is where you have to trust God and obey God. And a very fulfilling life and career awaits those who do this faithfully.
Yeah. Look at the ant, you sluggard. There's a good message there. David, where can people find your book?
So fulltimebook.com is a website they created. It has the link to Amazon and Barnes & Noble and all that stuff. But at that website, fulltimebook.com, there's a lot of clips and videos and reviews and things. They can learn more about the message of the book there.
Fantastic. David, thanks ever so much for joining us, for being at the conference, but also for taking time to do this interview. And that's all we've got for today. We will see you again next week. And as always, we remind you that from him and through him and to him are all things. To God be the glory.